Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight's show is, again, on the general area of metaphysics and spirituality, although I would say tonight is probably going to be as much as a mixture of physics with metaphysics, as I sometimes do. I thought we would talk about how did the part of the universe that many people call our whole universe, where everything we see, you know, everything we experience seems to be, how did it begin? And to talk about that, of course, I'm going to need to talk about parts of our universe that many people may not believe exist, or some people just don't know, and that was a predecessor to the existence of the universe we're in. But nonetheless, it still explains a great deal about why and how our universe exists as it does. The why part is the thing I think is most interesting. Now, if you would like to call in and participate, you can do so. If you're in the U.S., you can try us at 877-876-5227, or for those of you in Canada, 888-815-9756. Okay, so let me first of all define what I'm talking about by saying the universe, because it's a big, huge place that is, by most people's standards, probably bigger than they can conceive, because there are literally about, give or take, somewhere between 100 and 200 billion galaxies. And we're inside of a galaxy right now, of course, us. And the galaxies are just huge. And many years ago, people thought that a galaxy was a universe. And before that, they thought that our solar system was almost the universe. So, I mean, we've kind of been expanding out our reaches. And there's these hundred or more billion galaxies that go out for such a great distance, such a great size, that it is mind-boggling. And each galaxy has 100 to 200 billion stars in it. So if you start thinking about that, it's just a very, very big place. Now, in between galaxies, along, we'll say, the path in which they seem to have concentrated, there's also dust and gases and other forms of energy. But this is not really the important point of what tonight's show is about. The idea is, okay, we have a universe here of all this stuff, and where did it come from, and more importantly, why is it there? And I'm going to kind of go back to the more or less beginning point that physics presently recognizes as like the beginning of time and space in our universe. And that point is literally a place that is so small it's almost impossible for us to conceive of it. It's way smaller than what we can consider like an atom is. And an atom is very, very small, of course. But it's way smaller than that. And it's so infinitely small that it's really not even definable. And supposedly from this one speck of whatever you want to call it, which is tremendously infinitely hot and has incredible amounts of supposedly energy within it, came everything that we think of as being our universe. And that, for most of you, or many of you, you would recognize it as being the Big Bang. Okay, that's the word that a lot of people now know about. And from that, everything came forth. Of course, that sounds really good, and in some respects, it is true, at least in terms of, was there a Big Bang? Yes. And did all of the physical things that we seem to be aware of seemingly come from this Big Bang? Actually, that is true as well. But then the problem becomes, first of all, that after the Big Bang, physics people have discovered that there was a period of time in which time and space, now remember, the two are kind of intertwined together. They're kind of connected. So as space is a thing, so is time connected to it, a thing, so to speak. And time and space expanded at a rate that was greater than physics can explain. In other words, there was this period of time, a few hundred million years, in which the amount of time and space changes were greater than the speed at which light moves by a factor of a considerable amount. It wasn't like a little bit greater, it was a huge amount greater. And this is called the expansion period. Some people are trying to explain it in various different ways. And the problem has been that all of those ways produces some kind of exception to the rule, so to speak, in physics. And it leads to a thing called asymmetry, or a type of physics in which during one part of existence and one place in existence, which is like the beginning of the universe, there was a different kind of physics than there is in another part of the universe and at a different time. So asymmetry physics bothers people because our models of physics as they are today are based upon symmetry. Symmetry means that what is happening here happens all over the place, and it happens no matter what period of time we're looking at. It happens today, it happens yesterday, it happens tomorrow, and the physics remains the same. But that isn't what has been discovered. And especially in the last few years, this has really bothered some physicists because they really want, in this thing called a standard model of physics, for there to be consistency. Like, yeah, if we're going to have physics in this universe, the laws of physics should be applicable wherever you might be. And also, many years ago, a fellow named Stephen Hawking, of course a lot of you have heard of him, discovered that if around a black hole, there's some other problems about physics that are similar to the time and space problems that take place, that has been determined at the beginning of what supposedly is the beginning of our universe, in that time and space don't any longer adhere to the laws of physics that are symmetrical. In other words, that fit the same laws that we use here on Earth and other places. There's a breakdown. There's a change. Now, I'm going to try to explain this, why that's the case and where all this is really leading to. It's so exciting to me because for decades I've been teaching about this and and also predicting that it would be found to be true that there was asymmetry in physics. And you might say, well, how do you know? Because you're just a guy who was doing psychotherapy and didn't know, you had some other stuff in science, but you really weren't one of these advanced physicists. How can you know all that stuff? Well, because I had experiences in out-of-body circumstances. It started in a sensory isolation tank, but it went way beyond that. And that I did experiments on myself and those around me in this other places that told me the physics was different and it was asymmetrical. So it was a direct experience. I'm not claiming that I'm the super thinking person that could have figured it out without that experience, but I'm saying with the experience, it sure helped. Because if you have an experience that tells you something is different and you can do a little bit of science on the side, you can figure out things that other people may not be able to figure out. That's how. I'm not trying to say that, I've got everybody else out thought in this situation. I'm sure there are great thinkers out there that can do on their own the same thing I did, but they chose or didn't have the same kinds of experiences I had. Okay, so there you go. At any rate, let's go back to the question, then. What is the differences in the physics that makes it possible for there to be expansions in the time-space of our universe that exceeds the speed of light by a tremendous amount, like multiple times faster than the speed of light could possibly be? And the speed of light is very important because it's the foundation, has been in the past, of what is called the standard model of physics and symmetry in physics. If you change the speed of light, you change everything. It's like, okay, let's dial it up 100 times faster and forget that we did that and pretend like all other things in physics are going to remain the same. No, it isn't going to work. It's not possible. even the most diehard physicists of today who believe in this model will tell you if you do that with light, you're not going to have anything near the same kind of physics. And you're going to have to go to a very, very different model or models of physics to explain what the heck's going on. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you how it all works, you say. And I'm going to start right from the beginning. So this is it. Are you ready? Because here it comes. I'm going right from the very beginning, not of the part of the universe that we live in, but from the very beginning of our very, very beginning of our universe itself. And I'm going to make it as simple as possible. I tried to do this on other shows and combine it with other subjects, and I ran out of time. I apologize to you for those of you who heard those shows and said, well, how come he petered out there? You know? And then we had other issues because we couldn't get back on the air. We had fires and other things in California where our station is broadcasting from. It. So it didn't kind of all fit together. So let's try to do this in today's show. And if we really go over today, I promise next week I'll finish it, because I will not leave you hanging again about this subject. Okay, at the very beginning, there was just a field of infinite possibilities. From that field of infinite possibilities, which is everything that can ever be, anywhere and everywhere, that's called a quantum field theory. That's a field of possibilities that are infinite because everything and anything is possible. But within that field, some things became more probable than others because they just sort of fit together a little better. Okay? As those things started to fit together a little better, they became what we might call a thinking being. Now, this can happen time and time again. It doesn't just happen necessarily once. But the being that comes out of this infinite field of possibilities is so huge that it's capable of literally creating what we call a universe on its own. Yeah. It's an amazing event. It is self-created. It doesn't come from something else. It doesn't have to come from something else. It comes from the fact that it is self-thinking and therefore self-creating. And you could say, well, what is thought then? Well, thought is a bunch of, usually, but at least two or more, choices that have a similar direction to each other and are connected together in a way that affects other choices within and around them in a field of choices. And that's what we're talking about. It's an infinite field of possibilities. They're all possible choices. So this infinite field in itself continually is creating thought, and some of that thought comes together and eventually says, here I am, it's me, I don't know who me is, but it's me. And that me becomes a great being who says, you know what, I like me, but I like there to be more than me. And it says, I think I'll create a universe, because if I create a universe, within that universe I can create other things that could grow me, change me, become something better than me, but in order for that to happen, I'll have to make some sacrifices of being the only thing around. There's going to have to be other things. And those other things we call in our universe life. Life is the growth mechanism of its own creator. And the creator, you can call anything you want. I like the word God. Do you know why? It's a single syllable. And it's just, you know, it's like, okay, let's make it, keep it simple. God seems to make sense because, you know, if you want to use it, creator, well, that has more syllables. And, you know, but if you like that word, it's great. You know, and I like that word too, by the way. But all these words lead to the same conclusion, that our universe is not serendipitous in the sense that it was created out of chaos. Literally, it was created out of unity. The unity of a being who said, hey, I'd like to be more, but in order to be more, I'm going to have to be less so I can give up some of who I am so something greater in the long run can be created of me and everything else. And that is life itself. So this being says, hey, I'm going to create a universe where there's going to be life and there's going to be growth. And I'm not going to interfere with the thinking and the actions of a lot of this life. I'm going to allow it to pretty much be doing its own thing most of the time, although I'm going to create a universe that it has principles in it, that it has some of my existence, some of the essence of what I am, so that the life, if it chooses to, can say, hey, there's some kind of principle here, some kind of better way of being, and it can discover me as its creator, but only if it chooses to, and only if it can. So that's kind of what this great being did. It's a fantastic idea, and it's not all that complicated. I mean, think of yourself in that position. Isn't that what you would probably do? Because you wouldn't want to be hanging around completely with no one else and nothing else to interrelate with nothing else to have any effect on you or on anything else. It would be a boring place, you know. And that's what my understanding is of what created our universe, is a being just like I'm describing. Now you can say, oh, you're just inventing that. Well, I wish I were, because that would make me really a great, great thinker. But, you know, there's a whole history of this concept. And part of it, some people call it ageless wisdom. They call it different things, the great wisdom. Some people call it ancient wisdom. I don't use that one because it sounds like it's never changing. And it's actually constantly changing the way life is changing. But the point is that it has been around for a very long time, before recorded history. That's hard to believe, but it's true. This great understanding was available. And it is found in some religions as well. But more importantly, it's a great, we'll call it, cosmology and ontology. Those are fancy words for explanations of how and why the universe is the way it is. And so this gives us something to consider and understand. And you can say, well, why can't it just be that the universe is sort of randomly this or that? Well, because it isn't random. Because, as I explained in tonight's show, you'll find that it's just the opposite of randomness. That it is so well thought out and so well considered that the thing that's amazing is that humans up to this point, for the most part, have not yet discovered the things we're going to be looking at tonight and that I hope to convey to you. A lot of people haven't discovered it because it's so big. It's sort of like not being able to see the forest or the trees. It's just right there. It's all around us, and yet we don't see it. It's pretty amazing. I was watching a show dealing with life under the oceans. I think it was yesterday or the day before. And during the show, they're talking about how life is just amazing. It's been around for a billion years or more under the oceans in the most extremely inhospitable places, and yet it just seems like everything was made to fit all together. And that's one of the statements made by the people who produce the show. So you kind of look at that and you say, wow, you know, what's the chances of this? This doesn't look like it's really, you know, just all evolution. Because in some ways, it's the beginning of life. And, you know, the old story, evolution is great as long as you're not talking about the beginning, because what produced the beginning? Evolution is a process. It's not a creation. So you get into a real interesting issue there. Well, at any rate, that's another show and another time to talk about. But let's get back to, okay, the creator says, hey, I want there to be a place where there is life, but the life is free to think. That's the first part. And choose. And it's free to create. And it can create more of itself and of me, the great being, or it can choose to do the opposite, which might even diminish me, but that's okay, because the freedom is more important and the creation is more important than is the fact that at a specific point in time that life may or may not be doing something that is following in the footsteps of its creator. The creator had such great wisdom and has such great wisdom. It should not interfere, because interference destroys the very nature of what it's trying to do, which is to really expand its own self and expand everything by there being a freedom to create more and more of this growth factor that it calls and we call life. Amazing, amazing, amazing thing. Okay, so the universe is created by this great being saying, I've got to limit myself so that I don't have a great effect on life. The way it does this is it separates itself. And in its separation, it produces space and time. But this starts way before there is the etheric physical or electromagnetic physical universe that we think is the whole universe. This happens on a scale and in a level in which there are many more dimensions of time and space. And those dimensions are far more complex than the three dimensions we think exist within our realm. And within those dimensions, life can be much more, we'll say, powerful, much more capable of doing and creating more of its own creator. And unfortunately for us, as we are here, more capable of recognizing its own creator. You see, just the awareness of the creator requires senses of a sort that can sense the complexity of God. And where we are, our senses are so limited because the dimensionality is very, very limited that we have trouble sensing God. The good news is we can do it. Humans can. Anything below the human being in the kingdoms of life cannot. Things that exist in life greater than human beings almost always can. So we're right at the very edge of where we can perceive and understand, if we choose to, our own creator. The perception of it is hard and a struggle. That's what the show is supposed to do. Kind of make it a lot easier for some, I hope. And for others, they'll probably scratch their heads and say, what is this guy talking about? I'm sorry if that's happening, but I'm doing the best I can, believe me. All right, so there we go. We've got a dimension, the original dimension, we'll call it the first, very first dimension, that this being creates. And actually, there are three of them, the first, second, and third, we'll call it. And those first few dimensions of time and space are really coming directly from the thought and mind of this great being, who separates itself into three distinct parts. The first two parts have to do with thought specifically itself and don't have any form to them. And the third part has the form of a creator as it chooses to exist within itself. And it says, I would like to have this form represented throughout the whole universe, and we'll call that a physical type of universe, where there is always some type of energy at and below that level of existence. So energy is very important in our universe because it exists everywhere below the first two points, where first two dimensions of time and space, where things are most complicated, but there's no energy directly available to make forms. Instead, there is just pure thought. What a wonderful place in some respects. But a little bit less, we'll say, diverse, a lot less diverse, and not as interesting in terms of creating forms. So you've got to have free energy to do that. Now, I'm not going to go through each one of these dimensions in time and space. I tried to do that one time and just got me fouled up because it takes too long. But so a lot of other dimensions are made, a total of six. And in each dimension of time and space, there's a reduction as we move closer to where we are at the basement of time and space. And there's fewer and fewer dimensions. Each dimension represents one less dimensionality to time and space. And energy is becoming more abundant, but unfortunately, the thought of the creator is becoming more obscure. And things that are very important in terms of how life relates to its creator are becoming, we'll say, obscured by a lack of light. Light is the thought of the creator when we see it reflected in the form that is around us. It exists without form, too. But unfortunately, you got to have senses that are formless senses to be able to see it at those exalted levels of time and space that we do not live in. Okay. Now, here we are. We're on the verge. eventually you get all six of these dimensions of time and space before you get to us, which is we're in the basement at the seventh dimension. And what's going on? Well, amazing things in terms of the relationship of physics. In each dimension of time and space, the speed of light is being reduced, which means the speed of thought of our own creator is restricted. That's because the light is the thought of our creator, and it's being restricted. And at the same time, there are great beings that exist in those levels that think and that create well beyond anything human beings can. But human beings someday may actually evolve to be them. It isn't like we're never going to get there. It's just that we don't live there at the time and can't function there in the way greater beings and humans can. So, amazingly, there's a lot more variety to life, but there are less diversity of forms. Because as there is less light, an interesting thing starts to happen. A lot of life becomes so restricted that it functions in diverse ways, not at all towards the development of its own creator, but towards sometimes just the development of its own form. And form becomes a very big thing. So energy is like a big, big thing in the lowest dimensions of time and space, especially where we are. And you get confused because it seems like energy is all around you and it's all that there is. And so if you're a scientist living where we are, you might look out into the universe and you might say, you know what the universe is? It's a bunch of energy that is bumping into itself and moving through a thing we call time and space, which we don't quite understand, and is being clumped together by a thing called gravity and forced apart by something we can't quite figure out, so we'll call it dark energy, because we can't figure out what it is that's causing it to do that, and there's other things that are causing it to act strange called dark matter. So we are going to just invent those things to, like placeholders for an idea that we can't explain. And that's what scientists do who live in our universe today. They have this kind of, we'll call it, strange idea of the way the universe is based upon just being able to perceive only or mostly the energy around them. But they can't see the light of their own creator because it's being obscured to their own eyes. They can't see the thought that created the universe because there's so much diversity that it confuses them. They call the diversity chaos instead of recognizing it for what it is. It is the beginning of new growth, giving everything an opportunity to make something creatively change and different, even if it is at the present time, not in the direction of its own creator. Eventually it will be, believe me. But for right now, you got to kind of start that way and allow things to move ahead. Well, we'll come back to this idea. These are very exalted thoughts, I know. They're kind of mind-benders, I call them. The rest of the show will be more pragmatic, because I will change it in that direction. I kind of like doing that sometimes. First half will be all this stuff that's really far out, and then we'll put it into place when we come back from break, which will be in about 2.5 minutes, give or take, from right now.
What book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And some of you are probably saying, whoa, what was that first half about? Well, it's okay. You know, one of the good things is you can always go to the archives and re-listen anyway. And let me go on now to a more practical side. Okay, so we're basically at the point where we want to create the basement, the bottom of the universe as it really exists, where light is most restricted, which is the thought of our own creator, and when it's in form, we sometimes refer to it as virtuous thought or something of that nature. But the point is that it's the reflection of our own creator. And at the time that our universe, as we call it, our universe, the etheric physical part of our universe, was to be created, the creator of our universe, along with other beings, because there's a whole other part of the universe already existed, decided that the best way to make this part work was to initially create a universe in which, for the most part, the energy part of the universe would dominate. Now, this was thought of, course, ahead of time, but I'm trying to make it sound like it was done at the time, but it was really thought of at the very beginning, inception of the entire universe, all seven dimensions. But nonetheless, exactly how it was going to be done was added to by life as it had been created at earlier time. Now, the way to create a universe that is very dominated by energy is to have the energy itself actually begin the process before there is any light, before there is anything other than tremendous amount of form that is created. That gives the form the upper hand, you might say, in creating diversity and in producing a lot of synthesis in this diversity, so that in a weird way, we could say that it gives the darker side of existence and it gives those things that normally couldn't exist anyplace but where we are an opportunity to still give it a try, so to speak. You might say, well, why would God make a part of time and space where darkness can really prevail, where there could be such diversity that there could be some evil things or terrible things that might exist, where things might go awry? And the answer to that is very simple. At the extreme edges of creation, especially if you want to create as much as possible, you have to leave room for those things that you may not like, that may become aberrant, that may go in a direction that's really antithetical to life itself. Only because out of that will come the most unique, the most different, and eventually the most special kinds of life, because it will survive. Because ultimately, the system is designed for life to thrive and grow, even if there's this opening for some things to take place that aren't too friendly and wonderful. But you got to leave room for it to begin with, or you end up with a situation where the freedom of creation and freedom of thought will stifle the most and best that could be created. So to leave it open for the best, you have to leave opening for some of the worst. That's kind of the way it looks. And this is a very special part of the universe because life struggles the most. It has the least amount of sense of its own creator, but it also has the least amount of sense about anything. And to just exist is a struggle in the etheric physical part of the grand universe. And although we think we have three dimensions of time and space, you can boil them all together into one. Even normal physicists today can sometimes agree with that idea. And so, amazingly, we are so limited in our senses and so limited in the dimensionality, yet it's an extremely vast universe regardless. And you might say, well, what about this Big Bang? How did that go about? How did that come about? Well, the Creator decided that all of the energies that struggled and had not succeeded in being able to develop form in the higher dimensions of time and space got pushed down into an infinitely small point in what we call our part of the universe. That's where all that energy came from. It's the energy that could not develop into form in any other higher dimension of time and space. It's the flunky energy. It's the energy that some people refer to as non-divinic. It's the energy that some people claim is very gravitational. Yeah. Or some people may use the word, and I don't want to confuse you with this word because it's used in other ways, as energy that is elemental. It's energy that is extremely separative and only seeks to grow more of itself, and we call that gravity. So gravity is the dominant force in our universe because the energy that responds the most to gravity is the energy that kind of lumped together and didn't do much in higher dimensions of time and space. And the creator of this whole universe, along with its helpers, said, hey, we better sweep this energy down to the basement because right now it didn't do anything up here, and let's give it an opportunity to do something where it can do something, where gravity is going to be supreme, and maybe it'll enjoy itself down there and change into energy that starts to do something other than just becoming gravitational. So that's what happened. And you say, well, that makes more sense. Now you're talking about something I can actually perceive. It kind of like isn't all that fancy stuff you're talking about. Yeah, well, that's what I said. In the second half, I'll be more practical. Okay, so there you go. That's where it all came from. And you could say, well, why didn't you say that in the beginning? Because if I didn't preface it with the opposite energy being elsewhere, it wouldn't make much sense. So I got to start off, you know, explaining the bigger picture, so to speak. Okay. So all this energy is getting swept down and eventually pushed into one infinitely small point in the basement where we are, the etheric physical dimension of time and space, where we think everything is, but it's only the smallest part of existence. All this energy gets pushed down, and it gets pushed down, and because it's all pushed together, and literally pushed together by the thought of greater beings beyond our imagination, it gets into an infinitely small place, and then the beings say, okay, we're not going to pay any more attention to you. You're on your own. And you know what happens? Initially, this energy is so separative that it literally explodes. You might say, well, I thought you said that it wants to gravitate. Yeah, but it wants to gravitate on its own, in its own way. It doesn't want to gravitate because some great beings are pushing it all together at the basement of the universe. It wants to do it when and how and it feels like doing it and not do it together. It wants to be separative. And I'm going to explain to you how that works. There are seven major types of energy with seven subcategories to each one of those major types. 49 types of energies all put together. And each one only wants to be with 1/49th of the other kinds of energies. And it doesn't want to stick together with all, with the energies that all around it. And it says, forget you, I'm not going to stay here, goodbye. And that's when you get the big bang. Because it says, I don't want to stay here. But where is here anyway? Well, here was a place that didn't have any dimensionality to it. None whatsoever. It didn't have any time or space. But as soon as the energy says, I'm not having any more of this, goodbye, it opens up time and space. And it explodes literally away from itself to try to develop itself in the only way it knows how at the moment, which is to find more of its similar kind of energies to join with and to become something that it wants to be, which is more of its similar self. And eventually it forms one element, that element, and this takes like 700 million years, it's a long time, and that element is hydrogen, yes, hydrogen, and then part of it forms another element, which we call helium. Most of the universe is actually hydrogen, but some of it is helium. The helium is like the feminine side. Oh, you didn't know that helium was kind of a feminine thing. And the hydrogen is more like a masculine sign. Yeah, I'm giving you little tidbits of understanding here. So we have really two elements, but they're kind of interrelated in some strange ways because there's kind of like a different kind of way in which the things that are composed of these elements, which are called bosons and other things, are shaped within them. And one you could call feminine, the other one you could call masculine. Now, the other thing that I want to mention here is another kind of energy is also introduced into this whole spectrum. But it doesn't exist for about 700 million years. So for during the first period, while this energy is trying to get away from itself, there is no thought of the creator involved. It just is on its own, going to its own thing. And because of that, the thought of the creator is light. And the speed of light can only exist as long as the thought of the creator exists within some form. There was no form. And so consequently, we have something called extreme expansion, where the universe grows way, way faster than the speed of light because there's nothing controlling it. There's no enlightened energy. There's no thought of the creator acting upon the energy. It's really on its own. It's on its own for hundreds of millions of years. And the first few seconds, that first second, the energy goes from the size of an infinitely small point to larger than our entire solar system in a second or so. Well, I have to tell you, at the speed of light, as we know it, it would take like a very long time for light to go from the sun to... Well, I guess they don't include Pluto anymore. Poor Pluto's been excluded. But we'll say to Neptune, which is actually the edge of the planetary solar system, or out to the Kuiper Belt or the Oort Cloud, which is way out there, and that's beyond Pluto, which is still considered part of our solar system. So the whole solar system, as we know it, would take like a long, long time. We're talking like hours and hours and hours for light to go to the end of it. And yet, in a second, our universe grew to the size of our entire solar system. Now, that's moving. Let me tell you, that is really moving. And how did it happen? Well, it happened because there was no enlightened energy. It happened because there was no thought of our creator. It was like, okay, you're on your own. Go ahead and do whatever you want to. And this is all the energy that was being shoved out of all the other parts of the dimensions of time and space that didn't want to be on it, didn't want to be hooked up with any other kind of energy and didn't want to cooperate and didn't want to have anything to do with anything. And so it all went off and blew up. Okay. And you could say, well, that's kind of anthropomorphizing energy, isn't it? Well, you know what? Energy does think, even in a very, 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 very small amount way, even if you don't believe it, but what we call gravity is this thought of this energy, this elemental type of energy, that just says, hey, let's get together and just stick. And so it does that. It loves doing that. But it doesn't like sticking necessarily with all other kinds of energies. So it does it with some kinds and not with others as well. And you might say, well, they haven't discovered that, have they? Well, they have kind of, but I'm not going to get into that. Because I'm not really supposed to talk about things that aren't fully understood in science, but it's sort of discovered. So we'll see. Maybe in a few years, I'll explain more about what I just said. Okay, so here we go. Here we go. We got this really great expansion going on. It's super, super fast. But eventually, it starts to slow down. And the interesting thing is when it finally reaches just about the speed of what light really is, with God's thought, at that point, the energy starts noticing itself. It sort of becomes, you might say, self-aware. And it starts saying, what's going on here? Hey, where am I? What's happening? And it starts to actually exert some gravitational force on its surroundings through that process. So during the Big Bang, during the Great Expansion period, energy had so little thought that it didn't have any way of exerting enough force or gravity to start to change the Big Bang from a tremendous inflationary issue to slow it down. But eventually it does. And as it does, sure enough, another kind of energy that has been kind of hanging around, you might say, but really not part of the time and space that the first energy was in, which is already enlightened, is available. And that energy tries to coordinate and tries to produce elements, including the hydrogen I told you about and helium. And this energy acts with and in accord with the elemental energy to produce the very first true elements. You could say, what is that energy called that does that kind of stuff, and how come we haven't seen it? It's called divonic energy in metaphysics. And the reason we don't recognize it as being different from elemental energy is it is composed in part of light. And I'm going to tell you, the elemental energy makes up the nucleus of atoms minus the neutrinos. And the divonic energy is it composes the electrons that are in energy, and electrical energy in general, and electromagnetic energy in general, and has light to it, and includes the neutrinos. For those of you interested in physics, you might say, wow, I know something about physics, doesn't it? Yeah, I know something about physics, but that's what divonic energy is. So it's kind of neutrinos mixed in with some leptons and other things that kind of have to do with neutrinos and other stuff that also are related to and very connected to electrons, because the electrons are the dominant form of divonic energy. They have almost no mass. Some have more mass than others, and some kind of complicated thing. But the important thing is that they are a component. They have some light to them. And as soon as these things called electrons and some neutrinos were available, we could form atoms, and then from the atoms, it was possible to produce chemistry, we'll call it, and elements. Because the things that make elements, besides the fact that the nuclei become more complex, is really the interaction of electrons together. One set of electrons around one atom is starting to interact with the electrons from another atom. That's what this divonic energy likes to do. Unlike the elemental energy, which wants to hang around and just make clumps of itself and just kind of stick together, the electrons kind of say, hey, let's form some molecules and make some more things that can be useful. Let's make some hydrogen, and let's make some helium, and then eventually other elements as well. So this is how it came about. And it's very fascinating because A lot of people have read some of different metaphysical books, and they've talked about these kind of energies, but they didn't know that they directly relate to the physics we understand today. They actually do relate. It's just that they used different language before they understood atoms, and that language was more, we'll say, fanciful than it was descriptive in a mathematical sense and talking about the very elements of particle physics, which today gets down to just a few various pieces of the puzzle, and you put those pieces getting into all kinds of different stuff, hundreds of different things. But the most important part is there's very basic things, and they either fall towards the electron side and the neutrino side, or they fall towards the nuclei, which are like neutrons and protons. And those kinds of things like to stick together and like to be very compact, whereas the electrons like to get out and tootle around and move. And they also like to connect with other electrons and make all kinds of things. So you can see that they have very different kinds of purposes, and one of them is devonic, meaning that it's more affected by God's thought, and the other is affected by its own thought, which is more than what's going on in the nucleus. And the two have to work together to produce the foundations of forms, especially forms as we understand them in the etheric physical part or the electromagnetic. Remember electromagnetic? That's where electrons get involved. Part of our, what we call our part of the universe. Very interesting. Okay, so after hundreds of millions of years, you eventually end up with a lot of gas, because that's the first thing that gets produced, a lot of gas. The gas is hydrogen and it's helium. And you can say, well, what's that hydrogen and helium doing in it there? Well, eventually it is affected by the other energies, the elemental energy, to produce clumps of itself. It sort of gets tighter and tighter because gravity is pulling it together. The gravity still exists, but it's starting to work in tandem with the electromagnetic energy, devonic energy, to produce a chemistry, which we call the two major elements. And these elements produce eventually the very first stars, because when enough of them come together, they self-ignite and produce nuclear power, which is fusion power. It comes from putting things together rather than taking them apart. But putting them together in ways that wasn't as just based on gravity. It's based upon the thought of our Creator and thought of great beings even outside our own universe. This is getting a little far-fetched, because the problem is I didn't bring into you in time, because we're almost out of time, that concept. But actually there are helping beings that don't want to interfere with our universe, but actually have something to do with it from other universes, even beyond our universe, that work with our God and say, okay, hey, let's make some stars. Because stars could be a whole array of ways to produce all kinds of new elements. Now, we're running out of time, and I'm going to talk more about this next week, because I want to really cover this subject. I hope that I haven't gotten you too far confused in the last few things I said. But let me, because we're running out of time, mention to you that on Sunday, hey, I'm talking about understanding our universe. Yes, I'm going to be talking about that subject, because if it's over this subject, then it's a good show. And it's going to be on 1170 a.m. for those of you in Boston, Massachusetts, Dartford, Massachusetts, Providence, Rhode Island, and other such places. You can hear me directly on the radio. If you can't get to a radio, and or if you don't live in that area, just tune into WDISAM.com, and I'll be on at 1 to 2 p.m. That is in the afternoon. No, that's 1 to 2 p.m. Pacific time, but it's actually 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So tune in at that time, and you should be able to hear me. Now, if you're on daylight savings time, remember to move the clock forward, okay? And also, just to mention, Mimi, who's a member of a number of things I do, but one of them is being a member of the spiritual group that works together to try to create good in the world and do humanitarian things. She is going to be at Mesa Fiesta Borders from 7 to 8:15 p.m., and her topic is going to be talking about Atlantis. If you can get there, if you're in the Phoenix metropolitan area, please go. And if you don't know where Mesa Fiesta Borders is, you probably don't live here, so you're probably not going to know. But anyway, go ahead and visit her 7 to 8 to 15 p.m. Okay, next week we'll continue part two of this, because I'm going to explain a lot more about how everything got to be where it is. And then, if you want, you can say, hey, it made sense or it didn't. But in either case, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.